The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
When Carol and I come to this aspect of this seminar, we do it with a little bit of fear and trembling because it is such a delicate subject and such a personal subject, and yet one that we have learned in talking to many people is a very needy thing to be talked about. It's sort of, from our perspective, the frosting on the cake, though, to a good marriage. That's what I call it. What do you call it, honey? The oil in the machinery or something like that. I can't remember. But it's sure fun. And it sure makes life exciting. When God created man and woman, He made them male and female, as we've read about in the Genesis account. And He mentioned there right at the tail end of that first chapter, "Behold, it is very good." And according to God's own wisdom and design, sexuality was ordained for three basic purposes. One, the propagation of the human race. Secondly, for an expression of that kind of love between a man and a wife, which nourishes true oneness. And thirdly, for pleasure. And in my opinion, neither the distorted image of somber negative Puritanism, which formulated the philosophy of sex here in this country and others for many years, nor the new morality or situation ethics, which throws off all restraints and argues for sexual freedom, is really an accurate picture of what the Bible teaches regarding sex. According to the Bible, sex is a gift from God with a purpose. And the three things that I just mentioned are the three purposes. One, to provide for parenthood. In other words, the propagation of the human race. And this is talked about in passages like Genesis 1, 27 and 28, Genesis 9, 1, and Psalm 127, 3. Secondly, it has been given to us by God to promote mutual love. It is probably the highest expression, the highest outward expression of what the Scripture means when it says, "And the two shall become one flesh." It's beautiful. That statement is made, as I mentioned, four times in the Scriptures, in the passage that we read in Genesis 2:24, again in Mark and Matthew 19:5, and in Mark 10:7, and then in the Ephesians 5 passage, verse 31. A man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, those two aspects of sex are, from a Christian standpoint, from a biblical standpoint, are pretty obvious. Certainly the propagation of the human race is, it's obvious that if God wanted to do that, He had to have a way of doing it, and He invented sex in order to accomplish that purpose. But in light of that, it is interesting to me, as I have just thought about it and pondered on it, that God should come up with a way of promoting the human race that was so irresistible that man and woman can't stay away from it. Not if they, even if they wanted to. With all the setting of the jaw and the gritting of the teeth, the human race is going to grow. God made sure of it. And in one way, that's rather awe-inspiring, and in another way, I kind of have to chuckle at it because he sure invented something that was unique and ingenious to promote the growth of the human race. Fantastic. And then the third thing, which is really what I'm referring to here, the third reason that God gave it to us is just for our enjoyment, for pure pleasure. And I believe this is very clear in the Scriptures. You look at 1 Corinthians 7, for instance. Verse 3. Carol is going to get into this a little more deeply, but I just want to refer to it in passing. It's talking here about concerning matters that apparently the Corinthians had written to Paul about, and he says in verse 2, "But because of the temptation to immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband." The pull of the sex drive is so great that he gives us this warning about it, especially to those who are unmarried. And then concerning the husband and the wife, in verse 3, he says, "The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights." That's what my translation said. That doesn't really ring the bell with me. I never really think a whole lot in terms of conjugal rights. "And likewise, the wife to her husband." What it really means here, it's talking about the pleasure that is rightfully owed by the husband to the wife and vice versa. To enjoy one another. If you will, to enjoy one another's bodies. God has given us to each other for that purpose. Now, sex, as I have said, is a God-given drive. And every God-given drive has a design in which it is to operate. For instance, hunger is a God-given drive. He also realized that he had to do something about this matter of keeping us alive in order to propagate the human race, because dead people do not reproduce. And in order to stay alive, we have to eat. Well, if there was not some mechanism that God had built within this body to indicate to me and to you that, oh, it's time to eat. Why? I'm hungry. It's a God-given drive in order to keep us going, to keep us moving, to keep us alive. If we never had any hunger pangs, you know, there'd be a lot of people starved to death without realizing it. They're just so busy, they'd forget to eat. A lot of women, you know, they'd love that. Keep them slender and trim. A lot of guys like me would kind of like it too. The battle of the bulge. But hunger is to be handled within the framework, or it is to operate within the design of moderation. And the Scriptures are quite clear on this. And some of us don't handle that all too well. The spare tire around the middle is an obvious indication that we have problems in this area. I personally feel that ambition in many people is a God-given drive. But it is to be handled within God's design. And God's design is His will. What is His will for your life? And I feel that as long as I am in His will, in that job, in that situation, and I am walking daily in the light of His will, that there is absolutely nothing wrong with ambition. Of getting ahead, of getting it done, of initiative, of creativity, of moving out. As long as I'm operating within His design. Now, sex is the same way. It's a God-given drive, but it has a design which God has very clearly indicated to us in His Word, in which it is to operate if it is to produce harmony, happiness, and freedom from heartache. And that design is marriage. It is to operate only within the design of marriage. And this is very clear in the Scriptures. And, you know, I'm not here to argue with you about that. To me, it's very obvious that this is God's pattern and plan. And I am totally convinced that those who take this great and wonderful thing that God has given to us and misuse it and abuse it, they will have a hard time convincing me that they are happy and satisfied and finding fulfillment for a very long period of time. And I don't care whether it's Hugh Hefner or one of his cohorts or anybody else. I've read enough about that guy to know that he is far from what I would call happy, in spite of his whole Playboy philosophy, which is, of course, diametrically opposed to God's design and plan and program for this matter of sex. Now, I emphasize this matter of pleasure because of two things. In the Christian world, there are times when sex is looked upon at arm's length, and there are people who are Christians who still have the carryover of the Puritan ethic built within them, and therefore it's a contaminated thing. And this can have devastating effects upon young people if they grow up in that kind of an environment. When they reach the marriage bed. I emphasize it from the other standpoint that there is so much that goes on in our world today that plays free and loose with the whole idea of sex, which is sort of the Playboy philosophy, that looks so glamorous and so beautiful and is portrayed in such a magnificent way and with so much money spent behind it. But in God's plan and in His program with this matter of sex, He's given it to us to enjoy. And we should not be ashamed of that. But to enjoy within His plan and within His design. And there's a couple of beautiful illustrations of this that to me are kind of just really great. And I'd like to call them to your attention. Genesis chapter 18. Now this is the story of Sarah and Abraham. And I'm calling it to your attention to point out to you that Sarah looked at this matter of sex from the standpoint of pleasure. Now, of course, you got to remember that where we're dipping into their lives here, they're getting along in years. In fact, Abraham is 100 years old and Sarah is about 90. And, you know, I'm not sure what it's like when you get that old. But something had happened. And, of course, you remember the story that God had promised to Abraham a son, and that his seed would become as the sands of the seashore and as the stars of the heaven. And at this point in their lives, at 100 years old and 90 years old, he didn't have a son yet. But he was depending upon the promises of God, even at that age. And so we dip into the story in chapter 18 at verse 9, and it says, God has come along and He is speaking now to Abraham. It says, they said to him, where is Sarah your wife? And Abraham said, well, she's in the tent. And the Lord said, I will surely return to you in the spring, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son at age 100 and at age 90. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Now that could mean a number of things, but I'm taking it to mean that she couldn't probably have any children anymore, and that they probably weren't enjoying one another in bed very often. So, Sarah laughed to herself, saying, now get what she says. After I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have a son? And then what she says, shall I have pleasure? You know what was on her mind. And I think that's, you know, we think of those Old Testament saints, Abraham and Sarah, as being kind of a little more than really mortal. And we put them up on a pedestal and, you know, they're not really like we are. They don't have exactly the same feet of clay and so forth and enjoy the same things we did and have the same weaknesses. But that, if you really read into their lives, you find that that's not true. They're very human. They're wonderful people, but they're just like we are. When I am so old, shall I have pleasure? Now, out of her mouth came the thoughts of her heart. Of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. That's what the Scripture says over in Matthew 6. Now, it goes on and it says, and the Lord said to Abraham, well, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I bear a child now that I'm old? I mean, that thought God recognized, and that was the uppermost thing in his mind, was the fact that he was going to give them a child, and it was a miracle baby, going to be a miracle baby. But the thing that was on Sarah's heart was something different. Beautiful, huh? And sure enough, boy, the next spring, they had a son, Isaac. Now something happened, huh? They enjoyed one another. Take a look at Genesis 26. Of course, you know, even though they were so old, it is a miracle, but as someone has said, resurrection power works best in a cemetery. Genesis 26, verse 8, but we'll start with verse 6. Now this is Isaac and his wife, Rebekah. And they're down in Gerar. It says, so Isaac dwelt in Gerar. When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, she's my sister, for he feared to say my wife, thinking, lest the men of the place should kill me for the sake of Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. What a terrible thing to do. I mean, you talk about human nature, brother. That's a real example of it. Lying about his wife and calling his wife his sister so the people there wouldn't kill him to get at his beautiful wife. What a lousy guy. Yet he's one of the patriarchs of the Old Testament, Isaac, the offspring of Abraham. Verse 8, when he'd been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and he saw Isaac fondling Rebekah. Now, in one translation, it says sporting with. And I'm sure they weren't playing chess. So Abimelech called Isaac and he says, behold, she's your wife. How could you tell us she was your sister? Now, apparently, Isaac was doing something with Rebekah that he would not ordinarily do with his sister. And Abimelech realized that. Whatever that word means, fondling, sporting with, they were enjoying one another. So God has given to us this wonderful thing of sex for our pleasure, for our enjoyment. The book of Proverbs, especially chapter 5, verses 15 and 19, talks about this, and Carol will refer to this passage. The whole book of the Song of Solomon is really a love poem between two people who are madly in love with one another. Obviously a husband and a wife. And it uses very intimate and beautiful, and yet beautiful language in talking about this relationship that they have together. So the Scriptures are full of this thing. Now, Let's turn to the practical side of this matter of sex, the physical relationship, for just a minute. Carol and I have talked about some of the differences that exist between men and women. And the differences that exist here in this matter of sex are quite dramatic. And unless we are willing to recognize them and make adjustments accordingly, it is going to affect your sex life as a married couple. Now let me suggest three or four of the differences between a man and a woman when it comes to sex. With a man, sex is more of just an act, an interlude in time. With a woman, sex is involved in all of life. It is part of the drama. Now, guys, I stand here and I tell you that, and I say those words, and yet I am not sure that I fully understand what I'm saying from a woman's point of view. But I know she does. And, in fact, you will notice a difference when she gets up here and starts talking about sex in just the way she talks about it and how I talk about it. And I can't help that. It's the way it comes out. For a man, it's an act. For a woman, it's part of the whole drama of life. For a man, it's a strong physical drive accompanied with emotional needs. For a woman, it is strong emotional needs accompanied with physical needs. In many times with a woman, it is more of a psychological thing than it is a physical thing. With a man, it is more important how often. With a woman, it is more important how. Quality versus quantity. With a man, he is quick to react to stimulation. With a woman, she is comparatively slow to react and needs to be stimulated. Now, if you guys are not aware of that one, you need to be, and you need to talk about it with your wife, and you need to figure out what it is you need to do in order to meet her needs in this area. With a man, he is primarily stimulated by seeing. With a woman, she is primarily stimulated by touch and by tenderness. It's part of the environment. It's part of the drama. That's why the tenderness is such an important thing. For a man, his basic makeup sexually, his basic makeup is more sexual than paternal. Whereas with a woman, her basic makeup is more maternal than sexual. In other words, a man is a lot less inclined to think of the product of the sex act resulting in a son or a daughter, whereas a woman is more inclined to think of it along those lines, that she's liable to end up being a mother. Now, I think I could summarize everything that I've said on the matter of these differences with just a little illustration. In comparing a man sexually to an electric light bulb, you flip a switch and on it goes. A woman is more like an electric iron. You flip the switch and it takes a little time to warm up. And also you flip off the switch, takes a little time to cool off. Now, guys, if you don't remember anything else I've said, please remember that, because it's very important. In the matter of learning to be a lover, and men, that's what we need to learn. We need to learn to be lovers. to satisfy the needs that that gal has that sleeps next to you in that same bed. And you know, I get so irritated sometimes with in talking to some men about this when they tell me what their pattern is. They have the love-making instincts of a frog. Typical situation. I'll describe it to you. He gets home from work. They have supper. He gives her a little peck on the cheek. Dinner's over. He sits down, reads the paper, watches a little TV, and it gets to be bedtime. So he goes into the bathroom and takes care of things and changes clothes, gets into his pajamas, and then she does the same thing, and they both climb in bed, and they read a little while, and finally she reaches over and turns her light out, and he reads a few minutes longer, and finally he reaches over and turns his light out, and there they are, laying there in the dark. And then all of a sudden, out of the dark, comes this hand. What a romantic setting. What a psychological buildup. Like I say, the sexual instincts of a frog. Now, men, we can do better than that. And those gals deserve better than that. One time after we had had this thing, this seminar, a wife came up to me. I saw her, it was a month or so after she and her husband attended the seminar, and I ran into her someplace. She smiled and she says, "You know, Jim now on occasion in the afternoon will call me on the phone and we'll get to chatting. He'll say, by the way, honey, turn on the iron." You know, I think that's beautiful. That's fantastic. But you know, guys, that's what a woman needs. And boy, if we, you know, what you've got on your mind all day, sometimes, waiting to get home that night, and she doesn't know anything about it, and you get home and then that hand comes out of the dark. Boy, she's not ready for that. But before you leave the house in the morning, if you give her that little peck on the cheek or a good hug and a good kiss, and then say those few little words that most couples have got a little bit of patter between them that they know exactly what they mean. It's either verbal or nonverbal communication, or it's a little sly way of saying something now and then. She knows what you mean. That'll turn up her thermostat just a little bit and leave it on all day long. And by the time you get home, brother, the atmosphere has been created. And the evening is very enjoyable, and you can have a wonderful time that night. Now, guys, that's what a girl needs. That's what that gal that you love needs. And the thing that we both, Carol and I, and both encourage you to do in this whole area of the physical relationship is communicate on it. What is it that will meet your need as a wife, as a husband? What can he do that'll make it that much more enjoyable for you, or vice versa? Now, someone has said that what every man wants is an angel in the home and a tiger in bed. But sometimes, guys, if we do not communicate to that little gal what it is that really turns us on, she'll never know. For instance, just take the matter of the degree of dress or undress. Have you ever talked about that together? What is it that she wears or doesn't wear that will really turn you on. Now, all of us are different on that score. I mean, you know, the black nightgown doesn't turn every guy on. Sometimes it's no black nightgown or something else. Now, those of us who've been married for quite a number of years, we've gotten very courageous in this area, and it really isn't much of a chore anymore for us to walk into the lingerie department of a big department store and buy something for our wives, some little thing, you know, and you walk up to the counter very bravely and with your chest stuck out, and like you do this every day of the week, you know, and say, I'll take one of those. But for you younger guys, you've got to get brave to do that. It takes courage just to get through that door of the department store. But why not, huh? Buy her some little thing once in a while and bring it home and let her know that it's a gesture of appreciation and love. It's probably something she'll only wear for you, but she'll love you for it. And it'll also let her know what turns you on. Now, I talked about the hand reaching out of the blackness, you know, that I'm sure that none of you guys are that way. But we do need to set the stage and use our imagination and be creative in this area, just like in other areas of our marriage relationship. And there are all kinds of things that I'm sure you've thought of and can do. Have you ever pretended, for instance? You know, here you are on a desert island with this gorgeous gal, and you know, you're isolated, there's nobody else around, water everywhere, and you don't have a boat. I mean, what are you going to do that night? You know, you can really let your imagination run loose and just have a great time loving one another. Or snowbound. Colorado, you know, we get snowbound. That's great. Let me just mention a couple of things that are, from time to time, problems, mostly mentally, just in the thinking processes of various people. You read marriage manuals, and in many of them, you get the idea that the ideal, the epitome of sex relationship between a husband and a wife is to have a climax together. Carol and I are a little bit turned off by this type of approach because it holds something out like a carrot, which need not be the case because it really isn't that important as long as both of you are enjoying it and both of you are reaching a climax, which, you know, if you're not, why, maybe you need to talk to somebody and get some help in this area. But it's a great thing if that happens. But don't hold it out as an ideal and feel that you are being coming short of that which is the greatest if you don't reach that ideal. The important thing is to enjoy one another. Another thing that is sometimes a misnomer is that, oh, it always ought to be just the greatest, thrilling, most exciting thing that has ever happened. Well, it's always thrilling and it's always exciting, but it's not always alike. Now, one of my favorite meals is to sit down to a nice big steak, a baked potato, some rolls, and a nice dessert. And I am perfectly, that is a banquet for me. But you know, I also like McDonald's hamburgers. I love McDonald's hamburgers. And I'm satisfied with either. Well, that's kind of the way it is in sex. Sometimes it's the steak and baked potato, and other times it's McDonald's hamburgers. But it's always great. And it satisfies my need and hers. So recognize this and and understand that that's just the way it is. And there's nothing wrong with you if it isn't, you know, the top of the mountain every time. Now, the last thing that I want to emphasize, and then Carol is going to come up and talk about this from a woman's viewpoint, and I'm repeating myself here, but I cannot emphasize the importance of this, and it's the very reason why we've got you husbands and wives together, and it's very difficult for us to talk about it in this way when both are present. It'd be a lot easier for me to get you guys off into a room and talk to you, and the same for Carol. I think it's a little harder for her than it is for me, but the reason we've got you here together is because we want you to both hear the same things and we want you to talk about it. And we've discovered that this is probably the most neglected area of communications between a husband and a wife, is talking about the physical aspect of their marriage in a way that will be of benefit to both of them, to help us. So let me urge you to do that.
Thank you for allowing us the privilege of ministering to you by way of this cassette. You can multiply this ministry by sharing this cassette with someone else.
In the book again, The Adventure of Being a Wife, Mrs. Peel was asked to speak on marriage to an Eastern University campus. And after she spoke, this incident happened. The young woman who stood up at the back of the room was a college senior, dark-haired, handsome, sophisticated, a little scornful. "Mrs. Peel," she said, "a moment ago when someone asked you what you considered the greatest career for a woman, you said marriage, right? Well, let's be honest, shall we? It's my opinion, and the opinion I'd say of most of my friends, that marriage as an institution is obsolete. We no longer believe that it's possible or even desirable to link yourself sexually to one partner in your early 20s and limit yourself to that person for the rest of your life. In fact, we think it's ridiculous. Take me, for example. There's a boy I'm fond of. We sleep together quite often. I don't think he wants to marry me, and I certainly have no intention of marrying him. He's not my first lover, and I'm sure he won't be the last. But what's wrong with this? Perhaps someday I'll decide I want children, in which case the pressures of society will make marriage seem advisable. But until then, I want no part of it. And even then, I don't intend to be trapped in it if it goes badly. We're not blind, Mrs. Peel. We look around and we see what marriage does to people, and we don't like what we see. I think when I say these things, I'm speaking for a large part of my generation. Do you have an answer? How would you like to have been in her shoes right then? All the bright young faces swung in my direction, and I took a deep breath. It was true. I had said that, in my opinion, marriage was the greatest career a woman can have. I had agreed that a woman might have other stimulating and important jobs, but none was so difficult and demanding, so exciting and potentially rewarding, as the job of living with a man, studying him, supporting him, liberating his strengths, compensating for his weaknesses, making his whole mechanism soar and sing the way it was designed to do. I had said this because I believed it completely, but I hadn't expected a challenge quite so blunt and harsh as this one. Modern marriage, this handsome young woman was saying, was a fraud and a mockery, and she wanted to know if I had an answer. "Yes," I said to her quietly, "I have an answer because I'm in the process of living it. I consider myself one of the most fortunate women alive. Why? Because I am totally married to a man in every sense of the word, physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. We're so close that you couldn't put a knife blade between us. I need him and depend on him completely. He completely needs and depends on me. We're not two lonely, competing individuals. We're one integrated, mutually responsive, mutually supportive organism. And this is such a marvelous and joyous thing that nothing else in life can even approach it. It's the greatest of all adventures. But you'll never know it. You'll never even come within shouting distance of it if you maintain the attitudes and the code of conduct you've adopted. I don't see why not, she said. But her voice had lost some of its conviction. Why can't a man-woman relationship be just as meaningful outside of marriage as in it? Because, I told her, it doesn't have the key ingredients. It doesn't have the commitment. It doesn't have the permanence. It can never achieve the depth that comes from total sharing, from working together toward common goals year after year, from knowing that you're playing the game for keeps. Do you think that my husband and I achieve the relationship we have just by thinking happy thoughts or waving a magic wand? Don't be absurd. We fought for this relationship. We hammered it out on the anvil of joy and sorrow, of pain and problems. Yes, at times of discouragement and disagreement. But we never thought of marriage as a trap. We thought of it as a privilege. And there's quite a difference. I read you that this afternoon because I feel that God has given Jack and me a relationship like that, that kind of closeness. But we fought for that relationship, sometimes quite literally. We've hammered it out on the anvil of pain and problems, discouragements, frustrations, disagreements, of joy and sorrow. But oh, it's been worth it. Every moment has been worth it. But friends, if we didn't have that God-given viewpoint of marriage, we never would have made it. There are times in any marriage when you think, is it worth it? You know, if we really didn't have the permanence of a relationship to fight for, to work through, you'd throw in the towel. And there isn't a couple in a million that would ever really make the grade and get across on the other side. Now, part of it is in this marriage of the physical, in this area of the physical. Many, many times I get the question from wives, how can I really keep my marriage exciting? Lots of times a wife will say, you know, we have a good thing going, and we love each other. But somehow the fun, the excitement, the sparkle has faded from our relationship. And as I ask a few questions, many times a wife has stopped meeting her husband at the door with joy, stopped really greeting him like he was somebody special, stopped doing a lot of the little things that can contribute to this. But often, too, as I probe a little bit, I find that their sex life has become a very routine thing. And let's face it, a lot of the little jokes, a lot of the little fun things that go on between a couple have to do with this very area of sex. Now, with a woman, you cannot separate love and sex. They're just really very intertwined in our inner being. In fact, sometimes a woman longs much more for the closeness of the intimate oneness in sex than she does the excitement of it. Many times, men, we just want to be held totally apart from any sex. We just want the closeness of being held. It's something for you to put up here. Because sometimes I just snuggle up to Jack and I say, I just want to lay here on your shoulder for a while. and be close. And I long for that. Someday, I'm going to write an article. I keep threatening to do this. But I'm going to write an article on Proverbs 5, and I'm going to call it Deep Wells or Muddy Puddles. And the reason I'm going to call it that is because Proverbs 5 is a very beautiful picture of what God has in the sexual union. And God speaks of the sex act between a husband and wife as being like a deep well with waters that keep springing up ever fresh. The world is trying to get us to believe that this is a very shallow thing. In fact, I read an article not long ago. It made me very angry. But it was two college students, and the whole idea was, why should it hurt anymore after a fellow and a girl have gone to bed together if they break up than if they hadn't? You know, it's just another body function. And so why should it hurt? They're trying to make it so shallow. And in Proverbs 5, it talks about the fact that you throw your water on the streets. You know, you spread it around. You have sex with everybody. And it becomes like muddy puddles. When God has so much more for it than that. God wants it to be like a deep well. More beautiful all the time. And it should be that and can be that. I've had people that aren't married say, well, don't you ever get tired of it? And I'm thinking, do you ever get tired of a long, cold drink of water when you're thirsty? Never. Now, there are creative things you can do, keeping variety and fun in it. But God is a creative God. Do you ever pray for creative ideas about your sex life? You can. Do you ever pray that you'll really be a blessing to the other person in your physical relationship? You can. Do you ever ask God for His point of view in these things? Some of you who have real hang-ups from your childhood on this? You can. God is interested in all of the problem areas that we have along this line, of which there are many. Now, God speaks of sex as knowledge. Remember the Old Testament word that's used for intercourse? Abraham knew his wife, and they conceived. He knew her. I think that's a beautiful word. Because to me, sex is total communication. Body, soul, and spirit. That's what I want of it, and that's what it can be. Total communication. Proverbs 5:18 says, let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. And that's what it should be, an exhilaration of our love. Now, today, we're not talking about technique, obviously. You can pick up many good books to get the technique, and you should. We recommend Herbert Miles's Sexual Happiness in Marriage as one that is written from a truly evangelical viewpoint, a real Christian viewpoint, and yet very frank. And we would recommend that you read this together, out loud. And you couples who are engaged, my daughter's going to be married in 5 weeks, so I just had her read it completely. And then we want her fiance to read it. And then about 2 weeks before they're married, so they don't have all kinds of thought problems before then, to read it together out loud. Now, the reason we want them to do that is so that they will get used to saying the words to one another. as well as start talking about the concepts with one another. We find great many couples who simply can't even verbalize parts of the body. They're really hung up on this kind of thing. So if you read something like that, you will be spelling out words that maybe are hard for you to get out. One summer, four different women came to me within a week with four problems that I thought at the time were quite far out. And I had discovered since in talking to a number of wives that they aren't all that uncommon. And the beautiful thing is that God has the answers to almost any sex problem that you have. You know, the Bible is not only the best marriage manual that we have, but it really has answers on this particular aspect of the marriage life as well. Now let me exemplify. The four problems these women had were, one woman said that although she had been married for a number of years, she had never, to her knowledge, experienced a climax. This is very common. Another woman said that her husband so repulsed her that she couldn't even stand to have him come near her. He was quite obese, but that was not the problem. Another said that she was so shy that she had problems even undressing in the same room as her husband. A fourth said that her husband hadn't come near her in 4 years. That probably was the most extreme, but we find this frequently, especially in the matter of husbands who are alcoholics or have been, and they have lost interest as far as sex is concerned. Now let me read 1 Corinthians 7 in the Phillips version, and I want you to look for the answers to these problems in this passage. He says, "The husband should give his wife what is due to her as his wife." Now, of course, if the husband is a Christian, that is the answer to that man that's withheld himself from her for 4 years, isn't it? He is sinning against the Lord, not just against his wife. Now, maybe he needs to go see a doctor because there may be a physical reason for that. Maybe he needs to pray a lot about a victory that he needs in his life. But this is a sin against God as well as against his wife. And it says the wife should be as fair to her husband. The wife has no longer full rights over her own person. And of course, that's the answer to the wife who's afraid to undress in the same room as her husband. She has no longer full rights over her own body. She doesn't have to be ashamed of her body. She needs to get God's point of view on this. And I realize that a lot of girls have hang-ups because of parents, because of a mother who has not raised her child to see the beauty in this. But God can give you the right attitude as we make that a specific prayer.
Thank you for allowing us the privilege of ministering to you by way of this cassette. You can multiply this ministry by sharing this cassette with someone else.